This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
So I'm going to use Brisbane as the test case because that's where I'm living and this is where all the action is going the most of at the moment here in Western Australia. And Brisbane at the moment works on what they call a multi-barrier system. And all water, both drinking water and recycled water, are required to use multi-barriers now as part of the system about how they work. So it's not just one barrier to make sure your water is as low risk as possible. It's multiple. So if one barrier fails, other ones are there to pick up and to treat it and to get them down. So at the moment what we have is there's barrier one, which is controlling what goes into our water. Then barrier two is the treatment of that wastewater. This is normal, this is what happens already. But then what they've done in Brisbane is they've thrown in these three barriers here, which are the filtration, the ones you heard about, the advanced water treatment plant. There's a microfiltration, which takes anything as to the size of bacteria, then reverse osmosis, which technically takes out anything bigger than as big as salt, and only water passes through. Then, to make sure that whatever can get across the reverse osmosis, they put in what they call advanced oxidation, which is very, very intense UV light, and mixed with hydrogen peroxide, which literally blasts proteins and other molecules apart. Then it goes into the reservoir, where it sits in the reservoir for a period of time, then back into the drinking water plant before it goes in. That's how it technically works. Everything's set up for this, but it's not operating at the moment because the Queensland government decided unless the dams fall below 40%, this is on hold. It's our safety backup, they call it now. So I'm just going to go in very, very quickly, show some of these things and the research that's been done to work out about these barriers. So if we look at barriers one and two, there's been quite a bit of work done on from the social side of point of view and from the governments trying to control what people put down their sinks. And this has been going on for a long time. Most of you will have that. Don't flush your old medication down the toilet. Don't clean your paintbrushes in the sinks. This is human behaviour type situation. Very, very long periods of time to try and change it. It's where they're going into the schools and working with school kids. It's something that we think is only probably going to change over 20, 30 years. We've got some research over here that's been looking at hospitals. Are hospitals really important for the delivery of chemicals like pharmaceuticals and stuff into the wastewater, which goes into the sewage treatment plants? And what we're finding is most of the chemicals, like the antibiotics and other ones up there, the hospitals are only providing about 2 to 3%. The only big ones were the ones at the bottom, which was paracetamol, was quite high, and another one, which is trimethoprim, was up about 8 to 10% most of the time. But it seems that hospitals aren't providing the large load of chemicals and pharmaceuticals that we thought of. The pharmaceuticals in the wastewater, and they are in wastewater, seem to be coming from the community, not from hospitals. So if they're coming from the community, then we want to know what was the sort of situation, how well were wastewater treatment plants, the ones that exist already, they exist to treat water to throw into the environment. But now they're asking the wastewater treatment plants to deliver water on to another treatment plant. So how well are they working? And we've gone and had a look at a number of compounds. There's hormones, plasticizers, disinfectants, steroids, pharmaceuticals, painkillers. And we find that virtually every chemical that they've been able to test has been taken out at least 90%. There's one that's the one I highlighted because it just shows that nothing's perfect. There's one that's an anti-epileptic called carbamazepam, and it's not removed at all. But this is well known throughout the world. It's a very, very resistant chemical. The concentrations in the water, though, are very, very low, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Another one, which is interesting, which we have to be careful of, is nonophenol monoethylene, which is one of the plasticizers. And it actually doesn't get broken down much, about 43%, but that's because nonophenol, which is its parent product, if you like, is broken down. So this has actually been removed very easily, but when you've got this compound here, it's been broken down to this one. So while you've been broken down, more's been added. So again, it's something that we need to... This is when you take this information, and this is what the people, if you're going to recycle water for indirect potable use, this is the sorts of things that they need to know about at the next stage to look out for. So they can ignore things like estrogen. It's almost completely removed. You can remove painkillers. You don't have to worry about that. You have to worry about some of these other ones like the carbamazepam and some of the plasticizers. So if I talk about barriers 3, 4 and 5, this is where the interesting stuff starts to happen. This is where we've never been in this in Australia. It's been done overseas, Singapore, California, but this is we're only just starting to think about this in Australia. And it's all done by filters. The same process that they do for desalination. It goes through a microfilter, which takes out the large particles, because otherwise your reverse osmosis blocks up. It goes through a reverse osmosis, which squeezes water across a membrane and technically blocks out everything else, and then it goes through this advanced oxidation. And I've just got a little bit of a, I think I have, yes. This is a, sort of a schematic that I've stolen from the Californians about how a reverse osmosis membrane works. So imagine that's a reverse osmosis membrane. There's a bit of water about the size of a billiard ball, and technically it can squeeze across. And then you come up to something like salt, which is about the size of a tennis ball, different size, it bounces off theoretically. You've got organic chemicals, which again, much bigger, and again, they're supposedly knocked off. And then you've got bacteria and viruses, which are huge. So that's it in the theory. And you'll get some engineers who turn up and say, this is absolute, can't happen. But the reality is, if they tell you that, some chemicals do bleed in very, very low amounts across the membranes. I've covered a couple of compounds are actually produced by the cleaning of the membranes which do cross. Not very big, and I'll show you that in a moment. And there is the risk. There is a risk that something could fail in this system and something could pass across a seal or a bit of a broken membrane. So again, if somebody tells you it's absolute safe, fail-safe, don't believe them. But what, all the tests that have been done both in Queensland and Western Australia have shown that at the moment, virtually nothing passes across except for minute amounts where they get right down to the lowest possible detection levels they got. So if you look at this, how do they then test that when it's so hard? And one of the ways that they've worked out is they work on not the individual compounds, which are so hard to detect at such low levels, they just amalgamate them all, what we call total organic carbon. So imagine that's total organic carbon. This is what they can detect everything of. And what they've discovered, looking at that and looking at what they're detecting, is that all the compounds that they can detect is about 70 to 80% of the total carbon. So it's only 30% we don't know about. Which is still that bit, that's what people come up, what about those ones we don't know about? What about those chemicals we've never detected before? And so when we sat down and thought about it, yeah, this is still, could be a risk, could be a worry, but then was pointed out by actually people in the Western Australian Health Department, and again, this is where I've stolen it from. It's a bit of a diagram. I've changed it slightly. If you imagine that big yellow, which is just spreading out to the size of almost this whole wall behind me, is the amount that you'd have in one tablet of, say, an antibiotic. And that's how much organic carbon we don't know about on this whole wall from one. So you'd end up, we worked out you'd have to drink hundreds to thousands of litres to get the equivalent of one tablet. Assuming your whole advanced water treatment plant is working correctly. And that's, again, working on that assumption of risk, to control that risk. So then we went into research. Okay, so we're still moving in the barriers. And the next barriers are the reservoir. Sorry, that one should be up here, reservoir 6. That one hasn't gone. Hang on, what have I... Oh, sorry. And so one of the other things, so let me step back. If we've got a problem, we don't know, even with that small amount, we don't know what it is. There's another method that they're starting to develop called cell assays. And these are live cells, which they grow, which come from often the liver or somewhere else, which react to specific chemicals. So this one's called a microtox assay. So it reacts to anything that's considered toxic. And so what you've got here is wastewater. Across that dotted line is the average for those two. And you can see secondary effluent and then the reverse osmosis water and a blank, which is actually the laboratory water, is so far below that. This has been developed at the moment. Can we use this as a predictive tool to work out if there's a sudden risk? The trouble is, again, is the response time. But at the moment, what we're finding out is that the level of toxicity drops significantly even before it gets into that advanced water treatment plant. Again, while everything's working fine. And one of our problems we've got is we've got to get it when the system doesn't work fine, when there's a major event like a huge rainstorm or something. And that's very hard to research unless it happens fortuitously while you're doing the work. But this is where we're doing things. Sorry, now I'm on to barrier 6. And just to prove to you, I actually do a lot of my research in Barrier 6. It's real hell getting out in these reservoirs and working on these reservoirs, as you can see. It's a horrible place to work. And we get out there, and what we do now is we assume that a pathogen or a chemical ends up in this water. We don't assume it where it comes from. We just do it from wherever it's coming from. And so what we're finding is that these are two well-known pathogens. This is Salmonella and Cryptosporidium. Some of you might have had some very intimate experiences with one or both of these microorganisms. And if they get into the reservoir, this is the time it takes to lose 90% of those pathogens. So you see, salmonella doesn't last very well at all. It's gone in 7 days. Cryptosporidium is a bit more of a worry because it takes about 45 days. So that's where we need to assume if it comes from somewhere, the people in the who run the reservoirs have to know where it could come from and how long the water takes to get from wherever it could come from to the where they take the water. So in the case of Wivenhoe Dam in Brisbane, there's cows standing in the water, able to stand in the water all around the reservoir. So there's a lot of places, because Cryptosporidium can come from cows, a lot of places it can come in. So that's something that they have to learn how to control. The easiest way would be to remove the cows, but there's political implications in that, which make it difficult. So we're doing all that sort of stuff. We're also just in the stages of starting to do stuff with chemicals like pesticides and herbicides and seeing what is the transient time, removal times by natural processes in the reservoirs as well. And then finally there's barrier 7. I'm not going to talk much about this because this is the normal drinking water plants that we have all around the country. They've been operating for a long period of time. We know how well they work. The only thing I want to put in here, which is our concern, is at the moment how they process. As said here, Canberra's fortunate, like Melbourne is, that you have very protected, very pristine catchments. There's a number of other cities that don't have quite that luxury, like Brisbane, for example. And in some places, we have rivers and other sources, like the cows I told you about. We've got farmlands, washing pesticides in. We've got small treatment plants. I've been waved at. I'm almost finished. That can put things into these reservoirs. So if you've got water coming into the reservoir, we've got to work out how well the drinking water treatment plants. And at the moment, they seem to be working very, very well. We haven't had any time. They've done a number of studies around Australia. All our drinking water plants are working well, which is a good source of confidence for us that everything seems to be working, even if we go to this seven-cycle system, if the water in Brisbane gets so low, that things are working very well right up to that level of in the drinking water plants. So I'm just going to finish up indirect potable reuse. So my role is to research indirect potable reuse and find out where the gaps of knowledge are, where the problems are, where there aren't any problems. And I hope I've given you some feeling for that. It's done around the world. Do I think it's safe? When I look at the level of risk from what we're drinking at the moment to what the level of risk could be, I personally, and it's only my personal opinion, think that yes, it is safe. And I have drunk recycled water from around the world. And I've even let my children drink it. So I'm that bit. It's for everybody to decide themselves, but at least going through that. But as a researcher, I always say we need to know more. So the research will continue. It's not like that Brisbane's put it on hold for 40, unless it goes for 40%, therefore we don't do any more research. The research will be continuing to fill those gaps that I've alluded to, where we have holes in the knowledge to try and fill them. But those holes are, unfortunately, with the size of my children and the way they eat, aren't as big as I'd like. They're actually not as great a problem to do research as and maybe some other areas are in what we have to deal with. And I'm just going to finish up there. Thank you. So, like I said, I've romped through it. Feel free to hammer me later on when we get to the question time. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.